You're listening to the Libertarian Party of Indiana podcast, where we talk to the individuals that help move our party forward. I'm your host, Executive Director Chris Spengel. You can hear all of our podcasts at podcast.lpin.org, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Financial support for this podcast comes from the 1994 Society. The 1994 Society is made up of grassroots libertarians like yourself that donate monthly to the Libertarian Party of Indiana. To join, please go to lpin.org/join. We thank you for your continued support. Welcome to the Libertarian Party of Indiana podcast. This week, this time around, joining me is Chard Reed. Chard, thanks for joining us here on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Chard is running for Congressional District 5. This is his second time to run. It's a seat currently held by Dan Burton, and Burton saw the writing on the wall the last time around when he had about 500,000 primary opponents and then Chard in the general election. And so he announced that that would be his last term, and this time there were only 250,000 primary opponents lining up to face Chard in this general election. And Chard has done a fantastic job again of going out and working his district, and it's fun to sit down and talk with Chard and kind of catch up with him and talk to him about what he's been up to. So let's start off with this run versus last run. How does this race compare to your 2010 race for Congress? What are the differences of being a second-time candidate, and what are some of the things that are, you know, positive and negative about that experience of running again?
Well, I'll tell you, this time is sure a heck of a lot more fun because I actually have opponents who are willing to meet me and debate me. Obviously, Congressman Burton didn't see the need to debate me, and nor did many of the constituents. But with it being an open seat, Mr. Reske and I have been at every debate that we've been invited to, and Mrs. Brooks has agreed to debate twice. One of those is tonight, and I would really highly recommend that you guys come on out and support us. It's at Carmel, in Carmel, at the congregation on 116th Street, right next to University High School.
Yeah, and we have actually in the podcast feed, if you go back and you look, sometime around May, there was the podcast of you debating your primary. I don't know why, but a Catholic church let you debate probably 7 or 8 other Republicans, and it's the infamous Vanilla Cookies debate performance. So that's in there, and there also is your debate against your opponents in the on the Gary Snyder Show. And I'll tell you what, you have a reputation of being probably the best libertarian debater in the country. Why do you think that is? What do you do differently than other candidates or other libertarians do when prepping for a debate?
Well, I tell you, it's not enough to just know the issues. And certainly I know the issues, but what you really have to do is prepare for the debate. You have to anticipate what kind of questions are you going to be asked, and then how are you going to deliver the questions? You have to time yourself. You have to think about, what is my one-liner that people are going to remember from this? Each issue, I try to come up with one really good one-liner that will resonate with people, and then you fill the rest of the minute with content that if they're astute voters that they're going to care about. But really, you have to make that connection early with the average voter.
And what has been the response from voters about your debates? What have you heard from them?
Well, generally, after a debate, I have the longest line coming up to talk with me. Voters are very impressed, and Republicans, especially those who consider themselves conservative, I have a lot of commonalities with them as a constitutional libertarian. We both want smaller government. And although we don't see eye to eye on every issue, they would certainly consider me to be more quote-unquote conservative than Susan Brooks, who's a moderate. So I've had a lot of great responses after debates. A lot of people, you know, saying, I'm going to spread the word, can I have some yard signs, can I have some literature, and really excited just to hear a libertarian who's so passionate about smaller government and who articulates it in a way that they can really relate to.
Do you get nervous before these debates? I mean, how do you kind of deal with the nerves?
Boy, I get pumped up, man. And you can see it. My first response is usually on turbocharge. afterwards, I'm like, is there a way to slow that down for the internet? Because I get so jacked up, I'm just ready to deliver the big knockout punch. And it does get me a little bit juiced. Mm-hmm. So I have to be really intentional about staying calm and keeping my normal demeanor for the first couple minutes of that debate.
Well, let's get back to some of the differences. Other than being able to debate your opponents, what are some of the differences between a first run and a second run?
Well, this time around, I decided, you know what, even though it's very candidate-like of me, if you want to be a successful candidate, is what the system tells you. I've given more specifics than last time, if that was possible. I've created my own budget proposal, worked with Andy Horning and Joe Ruiz. I never say his name right.
It's Joe Ruiz.
Okay. I know. I mess it up every time. Sorry, Joe. My apologies.
It's okay, Chad Reed.
Yeah, it's no problem. Thank you, Joe. Joe Hopeman. Call me Chad. But, what we've done is we've decided to give voters an opportunity to see what it would really look like to be fiscally conservative. What would it really look like to take balancing the budget seriously? You know, my opponent, Susan Brooks, will say she supports a balanced budget till she's red in the face, or orange if she wants to match her pantsuit.
Okay.
But she will say that she's for a balanced budget, but the truth is her budget she supports, the Paul Ryan quote-unquote path to prosperity, takes 28 years to balance. She's willing to increase the national debt to the year 2040. My plan does it in 2 years, and mm-hmm. we start paying down the debt in the year 2015. So voters love to see the specifics of how do you do that, and what programs do you consider to be redundant, wasteful, and unconstitutional?
So you may be one of the few, if the only libertarian that has this type of specific plan. I know on the state level here in Indiana, as far as federal candidates go, you're the only one with any kind of a specific program, and you spearheaded the effort, and other libertarians signed on, like Joe Ruiz, Rex Bell, Andy Horning, all helped craft that and signed on to it. What was sort of the impetus of that? Why did you decide to create such a specific budget? How did you come to that decision to create that?
Well, I just thought, you know, as I listened to these Republicans speak about balancing the budget, I just always found myself, you know, wondering how they could be so intellectually dishonest and say they want to balance the budget but not provide a real solution. So I decided, you know, we need to create something that's legitimate. We need to find a budget and show exactly how we would recommend cutting spending without raising any taxes. How are we going to achieve this goal? Because it's one thing to say you favor a balanced budget. It's another thing to show this is how I'm going to do it.
And the specific budget it has caused some problems for you, I think. You know, I know that the Indianapolis Star, they endorsed you 2 years ago, and this time in the editorial interviews, they picked at that a little bit. And that specificity was actually something that they kind of picked up on and used as a weapon against you. I mean, is that sort of why most candidates decide to be less specific, do you think? And how have you fought back?
Well, certainly there is a huge incentive to be a coward. And that's why most of my opponents say things like, I favor pro-growth strategies, or we need to leave all the options on the table. And they don't answer all the questions on online surveys because candidates, as in general terms, they pander for votes. And I think we're way past that point. We need to get America back on track to sustainable path of growth. And the only way we're going to do that is getting serious about the budget, getting serious about tax reform, getting serious about all the issues. We can't just accept any longer when a Republican says they want smaller government. We can't just take them at face value. We need to ask, what does that mean?
What did that endorsement 2 years ago do for your campaign, and how do you think it helped libertarians in general?
Well, I'm certainly grateful for their endorsement. And I think it probably did add a little bit of legitimacy to the campaign and made some people feel more at ease about voting for me last time. And I think it helped the party as a whole, just because for the Star to endorse a Libertarian candidate for the first time shows that, hey, the Libertarian Party is becoming more legitimate in the state. It's having more of an influence. And I think it's good for the readers of the Star to have seen that.
Did that help you when starting this campaign again?
I don't think so, and I don't anticipate getting their endorsement again. They generally try to endorse people that they think are going to win, so they have some political capital there. And I think, you know, probably part of it is they were fed up with Congressman Burton as well. I don't think that I'll have that same endorsement from the Star. And I guess in some ways, people remember it. Mm-hmm. It's memorable, but I think this campaign was helped the most just by getting 8% with the student-run campaign last time. Like, that opened some eyes, and I think the vote total that we get this time is going to open even more eyes, and it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, you're a teacher at Carmel High School currently. You've taught at Plainfield, and you taught at Heritage Christian when we first met 2 years ago. How do you balance being a teacher and a teaching schedule, which is incredibly busy? You have two young kids and a wife. Two very young kids. mean, how do you balance all that and running for office?
Well, I guess the first thing I needed to do was add another job. I coach varsity golf, and I'm a manager at Chick-fil-A in the evenings. And I'll tell you what, I have actually had an ulcer for the past couple of weeks. It's difficult to eat. And I had to give up coffee. It was about one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make for a couple of weeks because it was killing me. But no, in all seriousness, my wife is great. She's really supportive. And, you know, she doesn't want me to be gone, and she gets frustrated sometimes. But she's got a great mentality of, look, if you're going to run, go all out. Do it to win.
I mean, I don't know a candidate right now whose spouse is not absolutely furious at them. My wife is angry at me, and I always joke that, you know, if your spouse is not furious with you in October, then you're not doing it right. So you're fortunate to have that support. You mentioned that you work at Chick-fil-A, so let's touch on that. What do you think of the Chick-fil-A kerfuffle that happened a couple months ago? As an employee of Chick-fil-A, what's your opinion, and what do other employees of Chick-fil-A think about that?
Well, I mean, let me say from the outset, I think Chick-fil-A offers the best customer service across the board to all customers.
And it's their pleasure.
Yeah, it is certainly our pleasure. And we certainly do not discriminate against any customers based on sexuality. So the truth is we offer better service to homosexuals than any restaurant in the country. And I think we have several homosexual couples that come in on a regular basis. I don't feel like they feel threatened by us at all. I think they're welcomed. I think they feel loved when they're there. And we actually have two homosexual employees that have worked there in the past 12 months. So there certainly isn't any discrimination in hiring practices either. My thing is, you know, how Mr. Cathy uses his money is his business. This is America. We're a free enterprise society. And if you don't agree with the way he uses his money, you don't have to eat his chicken. You can go get frozen chicken somewhere else. But if you want fresh chicken, you're going to be coming back.
So one difference that I've noticed from the last campaign to this campaign is a level of aggression that you might not have had 2 years ago. You've really, you know, the most aggressive stance that you took towards Dan Burton was your address for your website, beatburton.com. And this time you've really gone after Susan Brooks. And Susan Brooks is a former district attorney. She's the Republican in the race. The Democrat is Scott Reske, a former House member, sort of a union guy, and it's a very union-heavy demographic in that 5th district, so I think that's one of the reasons they asked him to run. Susan Brooks is married to David Brooks, who is the Center Township ward chairman here in Marion County, which is the very center of Indianapolis. It's a very urban area, yet David lives in Carmel with his wife, Susan. So there's a lot of heat for that. And David, the reason he has that position is often seen as sort of the hatchet man. So there's two questions in here. So we'll start with the aggressive stance that you've taken towards Susan Brooks and Scott Reske. In these debates, you really go after them, but especially Susan Brooks. Why is that?
Well, Mr. Reske and I, we don't see eye to eye on the issues, but he's a fine gentleman. Really enjoyed my time with him, and I've not been real aggressive towards him because it's obvious that we're different.
And he's the third party candidate in the race.
He is. He kind of turns into wallpaper at the debates.
Right.
And Mrs. Brooks, though, she has a lot of hypocrisy about her. She claims to be for smaller government, but she fights for larger government, and that irritates me. That gets some anger out of me. And I need to make sure that the voters of the 5th District understand that there's nothing similar about the two of us. Mm-hmm. She's a moderate. I'm the only one in this race that's truly for smaller government. You know, we've talked about her stance on the budget. She supports bailouts. Either that, sometimes she says she doesn't support bailouts. So it's one of two things. She either supports bailouts or she's a hypocrite who panders for votes. And I think that's probably worse. So I think she'd be better off saying she supports bailouts at this point.
See, that's what I was talking about there, listeners.
So, you know, even at her last radio debate, when asked a question about the real estate market, she said she doesn't support having making borrowers put a down payment down on a house. She doesn't think that's right, that all people should be allowed to get a loan for a home. And it shows that she doesn't even understand how we got into the economic crisis in the first place. She doesn't understand the Federal Reserve. When asked about monetary policy, she brought up taxation and rambled mindlessly mm-hmm. for 2 minutes. And she just really doesn't have any kind of proficiency with the issues. And apart from her professional experience, I have very little respect for her as a candidate.
So does that aggression in these debates, and I think if you go back and listen to the Gary Snyder debate, it comes across clearly that she doesn't have a lot of grasp on several issues like monetary policy, like the NDAA. I don't think she has any clue what NDAA stands for or what's in the NDAA, Section 1031. And you're not afraid to point that out, that it's clear that you don't know what you're talking about. Sort of one of the now famous Chad Reed lines is, the only way that that answer on monetary policy related to the Fed was you mentioned Ben Bernanke's name. And it was sort of a funny line that stuck with a lot of people. What has been voter response or response from the political establishment and the media? What has been the response to that sort of aggression and calling them out, especially when libertarians are not typically known for being the aggressive candidate in a race?
Well, yeah, I think voters appreciate the honesty. Voters don't like to be lied to. They don't like to get the simple cookie-cutter answers that she gives. I mean, she avoids direct answers the majority of the time. I've not really ever heard her give any kind of specifics on how she would hope to fix the problem, except when she gives specifics about adding more government.
Mm-hmm.
And voters love to hear when somebody puts her in her place for that. And they've said that numerous times, like, I'm glad that you stand up against that and make sure other people know that she is a moderate.
So we go back to her husband and also her moderate stances. It's sort of a perfect storm in that race, and I think that helps you, of a moderate Republican candidate. Here locally, it's been coined the Lugar Republicans. And David Brooks, her husband, who is sort of a political hatchet man here in town, he's created a lot of enemies over time. Have you been able to get any inroads into the Republican Party and maybe some Republican officials willing to talk to you that you might not, you know, and you don't have to name names, but, I mean, what political inroads have you made into the Republican Party to try and get some support?
Well, I actually have gone to several elected officials, many people at Tea Party meetings, and the response has all been the same. They fear her husband, and they'll tell me, look, we support you, we're going to vote for you, our family's going to vote for you. But I've had about 20 precinct committee men say, look, I can't put your sign in my yard, I'll lose my position. See, the Republican Party is nothing more than a cult that restricts free speech. You know, they say that they're for freedom and they say they're for smaller government, but their candidates don't even have the freedom to support people who have principles that match theirs more closely.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've come to candidates and former candidates, and again, they've thought about endorsement, but they realized for them, it's probably going to mean a lot of their money is going to dry up.
So there was a large paranoia within the Libertarian Party that after your 2010 run, and it was a fantastic race, that you would leave the Libertarian Party and get seduced by the Republican Party. That happens sometimes. And the best thing that Republicans can do to slow our growth is recruit our good candidates. And, you know, talk about the decision to stick with the Libertarian Party and you know, stay true to growing a third party.
Well, I think the Libertarian Party is the only party who truly values liberty and truly values private property. When you look at the laws that have been passed recently, like NDAA, that erodes our Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, the Patriot Act takes away our Fourth Amendment rights, they're continually violating our freedom of speech. You look at tax policies that are more in line with Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, which said the second plank to communism is a progressive income tax. It's hard to justify running with a party like that, who clearly doesn't have principles for what they stand for. You know, going forward, I would encourage libertarian voters, if they want to keep good candidates, they need to donate money. They need to make it happen. We can't win elections with $9,000. I hope to win this election, but the truth is I have $9,000 for the whole election, and Mrs. Brooks has outspent me 100-1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's tough because it's every single one of our candidates looks at our party and says, "Where are the resources?" You know, there aren't a lot of resources, and that's sort of the tough part. And you know, anybody that's listening that doesn't give time or money, doesn't give sweat equity or actual equity, please do. Because you're exactly right. That's what encourages candidates. That's what encourages party members. That's what encourages us on, is when we see a name donating to a candidate that we don't know, you know, even if it's $5, $10.
Yeah, and that's just it. And sweat equity is even more important. For example, I have a thing in my campaign right now where I'm giving people 40 or 50 postcards. They have my logo on the back. Doesn't even say my name, just my logo.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, you write a handwritten note to your friends and family, preferably friends and family who are Republican-leaning, so we can get new voters.
Right.
Don't just sing to the choir and send them to Libertarians. And if people want those, I can get those out to you ASAP. But, I, you know, that's a really inexpensive way to get out our message. You know, I'm paying about 6 cents for those postcards,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to reach 1,000-plus voters, maybe more if there's a couple you're sending it to or a family, and they talk. So, and I think that handwritten note is a lot more effective than these ridiculous negative ads that the two parties send out. And I think it's refreshing to voters to hear that I've only spent $9,000 and Brooks has spent $900,000. It shows that we're serious about streamlining the process. We're serious
sure.
about running a very efficient government, not one where she's wasting votes. If you look at her dollar spent per vote, it's going to be awful.
Right.
Mine's going to be a fraction, and hers is going to be a whole number times probably four. At least $4 per vote that she's paying.
And I think the conventional wisdom amongst the political class is that, you know, a Republican in the 5th District has pretty good chances. So I, as a Libertarian, look at that and go, well, then why are they spending all that money on a candidate?
Right.
Especially a first-time candidate that's not been elected. And if she gets elected, and you've made this point before, that she'll be in there for a while. So what is that money going towards?
Well, I'll tell you, I think she is a little bit nervous. She wouldn't continue to raise money at this point in the game with $300,000 cash on hand
mm-hmm.
if she wasn't a little bit nervous about the outcome. I think she sees the writing on the wall that the Tea Party has actually gotten behind the Libertarian in the race. They don't support her. They know her moderate agenda. They see it clearly. And she knows that she's got to really flood the airwaves here for the next couple weeks.
Yeah, and this is a point that I'd like to talk about. You have really, your bread is buttered with the Tea Party in a lot of ways. The Tea Parties have really come out strong for you, placing yard signs, passing up materials, not just this cycle, but last cycle. Why do you think the Tea Parties in your area have taken to you, and what have you done to create that resource for your campaign?
Well, I mean, before I was a Libertarian, I was just like a Tea Party member.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
that's where we first met.
Yeah.
You ran up to the Libertarian Party of Marion County and said, I'm thinking about running for office. And the convention was 2 days before that in 2010.
Right. Right. So. And so I understand the Tea Party mentality very well. And I believe in it, a lot of it. And, you know, we connect on the major issues. And I think it's important as candidates, we need to understand we don't have to discuss every possible issue with voters unless they ask. If they ask, we should be forthright and honest. But we need to tailor our message for each group that we go to. Always be honest, but always think about, who am I talking to? What is it that they're going to connect with me with? You know, you're certainly not going to connect with voters on, let's say, homosexual rights at a Tea Party movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have a unique stance on that, is I just don't think it's a federal issue, so that goes well with the Tea Party if they bring it up. But it's not something that you need to force,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think a lot of Libertarians don't have a filter. They don't think about what they're going to say. They think they can wing it and that they know issues well enough and they can just go in and ramble on. And I think you need to honestly think about what you're going to say before you go places.
Right. What are some of the issues that you talk to the Tea Party about that you emphasize with?
Well, obviously the Constitution is a big thing for both of us. The federal budget's a huge thing. Being against bailouts, tax reform is a huge thing. Issues like NDAA and the Patriot Act is a huge issue for some Tea Parties, not
mm-hmm.
for others. The Federal Reserve, which is one of my favorite topics, is a really big hot-button issue for Tea Parties as well.
So how do you deal with issues on gay rights, on civil liberties, on foreign policy, on issues that we may differ on? How do you approach those subjects?
You bring it back to common ground. You bring it back to the Constitution and how, you know, there's only 17 enumerated powers of the Constitution and everything else should be left to the states. And when you tie talks about homosexual rights into the Constitution, it makes sense. It's hard to argue with. The other thing is, as a Christian, a lot of Tea Parties are Christians as well, as I believe, you know, marriage is a covenant between man and woman and God, but therefore, I didn't mention government,
mm-hmm.
and government should be left out. So you can really take that issue on two different fronts, depending on who you're talking to, and it does resonate well with people.
It's always interesting to me the differences in candidates. If you look at this cycle in particular, you've got Rupert and Gary Johnson who focus on probably more liberal issues, on gay rights, on, you know, they're both pro-choice. And then you've got Andy and yourself who are constitutional libertarians who focus more on a constitutional government, on fiscal issues. You are an economist and an economics teacher by trade. And then there's James Neese, who couldn't be further from you. James is, a mutualist. So he's not a socialist, as some would claim. He is a libertarian. He just believes in more of a mutualistic type society. And he's in Irvington, which is a very liberal area. And it's always interesting to me the difference in candidates that we attract. And yet you all coexist perfectly fine and work together on a lot of these issues. So can you talk about, you know, the differences that you see within the Libertarian Party?
Sure. Well, I think that's the beauty of the Libertarian Party is we believe in freedom, and we live that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're allowed to disagree about certain issues. There's a lot of libertarians that don't agree with me that I'm pro-life. Mm-hmm. I believe that life begins at the point of fertilization, and the purpose of government is to protect life, liberty, and property. So that fits perfectly in my worldview of a libertarian stance, but for others, it doesn't.
Right.
And I can understand if you think life begins somewhere differently, how that wouldn't fit in your worldview. So, when we look at candidates like James and I, sure, we're going to disagree about issues, but we're not going to disagree about is the fact that federal government should be out of our life as much as humanly possible.
And even the state government in a lot of cases.
Sure.
Most cases.
Sure. And we need to make sure that we honor personal liberty, personal property rights. So those things are going to be mutual. We're not going to churn out cookie cutter candidates like the Republican Party, who basically it's their way or the highway. We have that beauty of freedom within our party, I believe, that really keeps us cohesive.
Right. Yeah, there's no litmus test here, and that's the way that I like it. And there are, I mean, as we grow, there are people who want to try and apply a purity or a litmus test to our candidates, and you know, I think it works great. There's something for everybody here. Is there anything you want to get across before we end here? Anything you'd like to say to our audience? Any messages?
Yeah, well, I could certainly use your guys' help here for the rest of the election. If you want to send money, at this point, online would not be the best way to do that because it takes a couple days for the money to clear. I would recommend sending a check. If you send me an email or a Facebook message, I'll send you my address. But if you just want to volunteer your time, one of the biggest things you can do is post my website, post some of my comments on other people's pages, share those on your Facebook and Twitter feeds, and just help me get my name out there. You know, the biggest thing is making sure voters know who we are as libertarians. If they're going to go in there, they're going to have to know our name because we're not part of the straight ticket pool that most voters do. They're going to have to go out of their way to vote for us. So if you could, please help me get my name out there and my platform out there in the next couple of days.
And your website is?
Chardreid.com, Chardreid, or you can access my budget directly at roadtoreality.us.
Now, Chard is an uncommon name. Why is it Chard?
Well, my dad was Rick. Mm-hmm. We're both Richard, so my friends made up Chard one time, and I thought it was pretty funny, unique, decided to go with it. Plus, if I was Richard Reed on the ballot, that's also the shoe bomber,
yeah.
Which maybe isn't the greatest name for a politician.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for joining us here on the podcast.
Hey,
we appreciate your time.
Chris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Libertarian Party of Indiana podcast. For more information, please visit us at lpin.org. Our music has been provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. To hear more of his music, please visit briankeithwallen.com or find him on Facebook. Thank you for listening.